Hello. I'm Alexander Danner of the Writers' Room of Boston. I will be your moderator for tonight's presentation with Hilary Shute and Sarah Glidden. I myself am co-author with Dan Mazur of the textbook Comics, A Global History, 1968 to the Present. I'm also a writer of comics with contributions to the nonfiction colonial comics anthologies. And I'm co-creator of the audio drama Greater Boston, which is a whole other form, but that's mostly where you'll find me working these days. Our format for today will see our two featured authors each giving a presentation on their work in comics and comic studies, which will then be followed by a discussion with the authors and Q&A from you in the audience. First to speak will be Hilary Shute. Professor Shute is a highly accomplished scholar of comics literature, currently teaching at Northeastern University in the Department of English as well as the Department of Art and Design. Her published works on comics began with her 2010 book, Graphic Women, Life, Narrative, and Contemporary Comics. She then associate edited MetaMouse, an annotated edition of Art Spiegelman's revolutionary Holocaust biography, tracing the history and development of that essential work. She edited Outside the Box, interviews with contemporary cartoonists, and co-edited Comics and Media, a critical inquiry book. She has co-taught with Alison Bechtel, she's earned several awards for her comic scholarship, and she has facilitated the contemporary inquiry in comic scholarship in general. Her most recent work is Disaster Drawn, Visual Witness, Comics, and Documentary Form, which traces the history of illustrated witness as far back as the 15th century depictions of military tactics. She then looks more deeply into the techniques and philosophies of three pivotal graphic documentarians, Keiji Nakazawa, Art Spiegelman, and Joe Sacco, who come to this craft by three very different paths, the first as eyewitness chronicling his own experiences, the second as biographer recording family history, and the third as a deliberate journalist inserting himself into conflict zones for the sake of witness itself. In the course of her inquiry, Shute examines the power of comics to convey history with emotional honesty while examining the challenges of ethical witnessing, temporal distance, and the problem of memory, and the friction that arises between truth and fact in an artistically realized historical document. Our second presenter will be Sarah Glidden. Ms. Glidden's first book, How to Understand Israel in 60 Days or Less, is a memoir and a travelogue, but it is also the chronicle of a young person's quest to reconcile her idealistic progressive politics with both her own Jewish heritage and the realities of everyday life in one of the most complex regions of the world. Her latest book is Rolling Blackouts, Dispatches from Turkey, Syria, and Iraq, another Middle East travelogue, this time touring the human after effects of the US invasion of Iraq. She is accompanying a pair of journalist friends, as well as a veteran of the war, returning to the country to see the end results of the conflict he participated in. Glidden does more than chronicle what she witnesses. She chronicles the process of witness itself, and the ubiquitous cameras and the microphones that accompany the travelers become defining elements in the story itself. With keen awareness of both the observer effect and the journalist's need to coax a coherent narrative from the chaos of real life, Glidden paints a complex portrait of the relationship between the documentarian and the documentary subject and the fleeting nature of truth. Finally, I want to mention that after the presentations, all three of us will be signing books next door in the Gordon Chapel. You can find us there. We are going to be rushed off the stage quickly to make room for the next people. So that will be a time for further conversation. And now, Hilary, if you would please.
Start talking. Okay. Well, it's such a pleasure to be here, and it's such a pleasure to be here with you. So the book that you co-authored, co-edited, which I think is called Comics, A Global History, 1968 mm-hmm. to the Present, is a really key text in terms of thinking about the kind of work that I'm interested in happening across the world, which is to say, drawing as a form of recording and comics as a form of witnessing. And I end my book, as I'll describe in just a moment, with trying to think about this new category of so-called comics journalism. And so it's such an honor to be on stage with Sarah, who is one of the key figures in this movement. So thanks for having me. So I'm just going to talk pretty briefly and pretty just in a basic way about what my book Disaster Drawn is about. And then that will be followed by Sarah's presentation in which she will show you beautiful images from her graphic narrative. So you'll just have to bear with me only talking with no visual aids for my part of this. So this is my book, Disaster Drawn. This cover, which I'm sure is very hard to see, I'll just mention briefly, is by the comics journalist Joe Sacco. And it is an image of the July 1995 Srebrenica massacre. And this is the kind of work that I got very interested in when I was a PhD student in English. So I have this kind of strange specialty. I have a PhD in English, but I study and research comics, and I study and research comics that are nonfiction. So the more I started getting interested in certain stories like Art Spiegelman's Mouse and Joe Sacco's dispatches from the Middle East and from the Balkans, I started wondering why this form of comics was so good for telling certain kinds of stories about world historical conflict and about trauma and about violence and about a certain kind of mass suffering, actually. So what I wanted to do in this book was to investigate all of these references that cartoonists that I had been talking to for years, like Art Spiegelman, with whom I worked on a book, and like Joe Sacco, who I've now known for years and interviewed in various publications. I wanted to figure out why they always talked about Francisco Goya, for example. I thought, I really want to know what this means, not just as a reference, but as a sort of trajectory of forms and a trajectory of trying to do the work of witnessing. So I'd say there are two things that my book is trying to do. One is it's trying to offer a longer genealogy for contemporary work like Sarah's, like Art Spiegelman's, and like Joe Sacco's. And to that end, my first chapter is actually about Jacques Callot, the printmaker who did a series of etchings about the 30 Years' War called The Grand Miseries of War that then influenced Francisco Goya in his Disasters of War series of etchings, which he did in the 18-teens. So I wanted to try to come up with a history of what it means to bear witness to war and violence through the work of the hand, right? So the commonplace idiom is that one takes a photograph but makes a picture. So what does it mean to be doing this kind of making with your eyes and your hands when you're bearing witness to war, which is what we see in Jacques Callot's case and what we see in Francisco Goya's case. So I wanted to put that work in conversation with contemporary comics. The other thing I wanted to do, and this is part of the reason I'm so honored to be on stage with you, is I wanted to try to give a more international dimension to a lot of the nonfiction comics work that is coming out. And a person I had been interested in for a very long time is a Japanese cartoonist who just died a few years ago, actually, in Hiroshima, named Keiji Nakazawa, who survived the bombing of Hiroshima when he was 6 years old. And he lived, his mother lived, his mother gave birth that day. She was pregnant, induced by shock on the road. That baby lived 4 months and then died. Several of his siblings died, and his father died. And he obviously was deeply affected by this experience, and he went on to do a comic book in the early 70s in Japan that is called Ore wa Mita and translates as I Saw It, which is a direct reference to one of the etchings in Francisco Goya's Disasters of War series, where you have an image and you have a caption, and some of the captions say things like, this is how it happened. And one of the most famous captions about bearing witness simply says, this I saw. So Keiji Nakazawa publishes this comic book, it's about 45 pages, about his experience and his mother's experience surviving the bombing of Hiroshima. And this really changed cultures of expression in Japan and opened up comics as a form of bearing witness to these kinds of stories. 1972, also the year that Art Spiegelman publishes a three-page version of what would become his two-volume work called Mouse. So Art Spiegelman publishes Mouse, 3 pages, in an underground comic book the exact same year in San Francisco in 1972 in a title called Funny Aminals. So I'm not misspeaking. The M and the N are reversed. It was an underground publication. Spiegelman's piece mixed in quite awkwardly with some lascivious work by Robert Crumb about some foxes chasing a chicken woman and eating her for dinner. So you can see there was a real mix of different kinds of taboo shredding work happening in what was called the Comics Underground, which was this sort of uncensored, uncommercial space where people did comics and distributed them and published them independently. So part of what I'm trying to investigate in this book is what's happening in the early 70s that's giving rise to these new cultures of expression from opposite sides of the war across the globe. And as I'm sure you can tell, I'm quite interested in World War II as an event that really reshaped how people think about how they can tell certain kinds of stories. And maybe I'll just stop there. I think it's about 10 minutes and turn it over to Sarah.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
I have a little remote control here. I'm Sarah Glidden. This is my book, Rolling Blackouts. And it's funny that all of the people that Hillary talks about in her book were people who inspired me early on, way before I started drawing comics myself. Joe Sacco, Barefoot Jen, I think is the same.
Yes, so this comic book called I Saw It became a 10-volume serial called Barefoot Gen.
Yeah, and that was one of the first kind of serious comics that I read, and that along with Persepolis by Marjane Satrapi were these kind of like my introduction to comics as not Mad Magazine and not Calvin and Hobbes. And I, you know, these were highly influential to me, but they were never things that I thought that I could do. You know, I'm not a journalist like Joe Sacco. I haven't experienced an Iranian revolution like Marjane Satrapi, but it did start getting me thinking about how comics can be used to tell other stories. Rolling Blackouts is a work of comics journalism about journalism, but my entryway into journalism was kind of sideways through journalism's like second cousin, twice removed, memoir, which is, you know, another kind of nonfiction. It was about 10 years ago when I started making comics, and I started by doing autobiographical daily strips. This is a way of just like kind of getting used to the language of comics, and you do something every day. If it's not good, it doesn't matter. You throw it away, and you do one the next day. And after a while of doing that, I wanted to do a longer work, and that's where How to Understand Israel in 60 Days or Less came in. I decided to go on a Birthright Israel trip, which is like a free trip for young Jewish people, sponsored in part by the State of Israel. And as, you know, a Massachusetts left-wing progressive Jewish girl, I thought, you know, oh, I'm going to go on this trip, and it's going to be crazy, and like it's going to be propaganda, and I'm going to make like a comic about my experience, and it will be just kind of like my journal comics, only longer, and it'll be a book. So that's what that book was, and it really was about my personal experience, and it was memoir, but it was also memoir that followed my interests, and my interests have always been, you know, politics and kind of contemporary issues and how my identity as an American and American foreign affairs play into what happens in the rest of the world. So as I was working on that book, some friends of mine, two of whom are on the cover of this book, there's Alex Stonehill, who's a videographer and photojournalist, and Sarah Studeville, who's a prose journalist. They, along with another friend of theirs, started a nonprofit multimedia journalism collective, first called the Common Language Project and then called the Seattle Globalist. Oops, I thought I edited these slides, but I guess I didn't. Sorry. I knew them from New York, but they moved back to Seattle to, you know, kind of make their journalism collective happen. Journalism was in disarray at the time that they started this, and they really wanted to just like do their own work at a time when institutions weren't really providing jobs for new journalists who are like optimistic about reporting underreported issues. So most of their work revolved around social justice issues, deportation and detention in the Seattle area. But about once a year, they were able to get grant funding to do larger scale international reporting projects, such as on the left there, you see they went to East Africa to report on water scarcity and how that affects conflict. On the right, they went to Pakistan a year later to report on madrasas and education. And I would visit them in Seattle, and you know, they would always have these stories about their reporting, you know, brushes with the Taliban, or you know, like having to sleep outside when there are lions prowling around in Kenya, and just stories about finding their stories. And I was just fascinated. Journalism sounded like this amazing, exciting career where like you're doing this heroic work of telling stories and you're seeing these amazing places. And you know, they were also telling me about how difficult it was and how hated journalists are and all of you know the kind of annoying logistical things that they had to deal with, but those were not the parts I listened to. I just listened to the exciting parts. And it really made me think about how I didn't really know much about where my journalism came from. You know, like I use the metaphor all the time, like think of it like when you turn on the faucet and your water comes out of your sink. Like, you just never really think about where it comes from. You don't think about the pipes or the reservoir or, like, how the reservoir stays clean. You just, you know, you kind of take it for granted. And that's how I had kind of treated journalism for so long. I just kind of opened up my web browser, and there was the New York Times for free at the time. and so I thought, like, wouldn't it be interesting to go with them on one of their larger reporting trips and do a book about how they do their jobs? How do you find an interpreter? How do you find your stories? And, like, what is a fixer? Because I really didn't know. So they said yes, and in late 2010, November and December, we went on a reporting trip to the Middle East, starting in Turkey. So in Turkey, we were interviewing Iranian refugees, and I should say they were interviewing. I was really just there as a shadow to watch them work. And from Turkey, we went over the border into northern Iraq to a town called Sulaymaniyah, which is near the border with Iran. And in Turkey, in Iraq, we were there because they were doing a documentary about this man, Sam Malkandi, who has a very interesting story. He was an Iraqi Kurd who was drafted into the Iraqi army during the Iraq-Iran war in the 80s. He deserted with his pregnant wife to Iran. She committed suicide tragically. He was left with his daughter, went to Pakistan. They were refugees for 8 years there. He got remarried, started a new family, and finally they were granted asylum in the United States in Seattle, where everything was looking fine until he was brought in for questioning because the FBI had connected him to an Al-Qaeda terrorist who was part of the bombing of the World Trade Center. So although they couldn't find any actual evidence connecting him to these terrorists, he was deported back to Sulaymaniyah, where he's from, and you know, we went there to interview him and talk to him now separated from his family. He feels unjustly accused of this crime and kind of just newly in isolation. The focus of their reporting trip, although, had been to talk to Iraqi refugees because the way they saw it was, and the way I agree with them, is that after Barack Obama was elected, I think the United States, and especially liberal Americans, kind of decided to turn the page on the Iraq War. It was so much easier to be optimistic about Obama's term starting and to kind of forget that, you know, this war, which we had all been against in the first place, had really affected millions and millions of people and left a country shattered and, you know, started the conflict that we see now in Syria. And so they felt, and I felt, that our generation, especially who were young when that war started, needed to really look at what the effects of this war were, the human fallout, and that would be Iraqi refugees. Half of whom were living in Syria at the time and half of whom were living in Jordan. And most of the Iraqi refugees living in Syria were in Damascus. So that is where we went. It was a very different Syria at the time. This was about 3 months before everything started falling apart. And we weren't there to report on the Syrian government or what they were up to. We were just there to talk to Iraqi refugees. The other wrinkle in this story was that Sarah, the lead journalist, decided to invite along a childhood friend of hers named Dan O'Brien, who was, like her, raised in a very progressive Seattle hippie environment. His mother founded an organization that tried to ban war toys. And his response to the Iraq War starting in 2003 was to join up in 2005. He joined the Marines and went over there to fight in the war. And this is something that his family and his friends couldn't really understand at the time, and I think still bothered Sarah to that day. So she invited him on the trip to kind of revisit the country as a civilian, to meet the people who had been displaced by this war he had been a part of. And her idea was that she would interview him as he went along on this trip and kind of see how a Marine returns to Iraq, and she would write a story about him. You know, I think for her it was a little bit like showing some real life journalism. Like, the idea of journalism is that someone goes into an issue with kind of preconceived notions, they think they know something, you read something new or you see something new, and then you change a little bit at the end. And that is true, but unfortunately that doesn't work on a timeline that you can set. And I think for Dan and for her, you know, they had a complex relationship as friends, and so their conversations turned less into interviews and more into kind of arguments that they had a hard time getting through to each other. So that is a big part of the book, is their conversation about the war. We were there for 2 months. The book took 5.5 years for me to make. And part of the reason that it took so long is because I wanted the whole thing to be real dialogue. So I was recording everything. That's me in the corner there with my little digital recorder. And I was recording everything, not just the interviews that I sat in on, but also our conversations at breakfast about what we were going to report on that day, you know, us walking around these towns that we were in, talking to different people, and then definitely, you know, processing the day's interviews over like 3 or 4 beers and talking earnestly about journalism and our place in the world as Americans. So all of that turned into hundreds of hours of audio that I transcribed, you know, myself. For about a year, it took me to transcribe all of this tape and kind of figure out how I was going to make this book. And some people asked me why I didn't just hire someone else to transcribe it for me, or, you know, why I didn't use one of these programs that translates text to speech to text. But really, for me, listening to these recordings over again helped me think of the book visually. When you listen to audio, you can remember how people moved because you've been observing them so long and you were watching their body language, and you can kind of hear how they talk and remember, like, how they shifted and, you know, when they have pauses and when they were unsure or sarcastic about things. So it was really important to me to listen to all of these tapes again, and it created this weird situation where I was reliving 2 months of time for 5 years, and that was very strange. The other reason it took so long is because it was just a more complicated book for me to do than my first book, which was more of like a chronological travelogue. For this book, I wasn't going to be writing about my imagination and my own interior thoughts. I was really wanted to explore the relationship between journalists and the people that they interview. And those relationships for journalists range. There are expert interviews. For example, in this panel, our journalists were interviewing a representative of the UNHCR, which is the agency that overlooks refugees. And with an expert interview, this person is used to talking to journalists, and he's not revealing personal information. He's just there to give statistics and just like plain old information. So that's like a really distant kind of relationship. But with the other interviews, there's more of like a deeper connection going on. So with Sam, for example, we were there for 10 days, and he has a painful story, one where he needs to really reveal all of his life. And so the journalists I was with like spent a lot of time getting to know him as a person, getting to know his family, and, you know, listening to his story. For Sam's section of the book, I do some flashback scenes, like this one where he's talking about his university days in Baghdad. But I really wanted for this book to keep it grounded in the present, because this is a book about the process of journalism and where these people who have experienced trauma are now in their lives. So, for example, we did the interviewing of Sam in this room here. Here's a photo of them interviewing him. And this room was significant because it was the room that he shared with his first wife before she died. And so in my comics, I really want to show setting. Sense of place is really important in my work. I take a lot of photo reference. And I use photo reference to show how, you know, these countries and towns that I'm visiting are different, because most likely my readers have never been to Sulaymaniyah in northern Iraq. But I also want to show how they're the same. You know, that blue chair in the center there, the ubiquitous plastic lawn chair, is something that I think all of us can recognize. It's a chair that, you know, might be in your backyard, but it's also in Iraq and it's everywhere else. And so I really want to show those little pieces of people's lives that are similar to yours, maybe, because the point of journalism, if it's narrative journalism especially, is to show that if situations were a little bit differently, this could be you. This could have happened to you. I need to speed up because I'm running out of time. But this is, you know, Sam getting ready for breakfast. This is, you know, just another example of trying to, like, keep things rooted in the present. And I use family photographs because we got to know Sam fairly well. His family is very important to us, so I wanted to show who these people are, who he cares for so much. For the Iraqi refugee situation, we weren't there to do a profile of one person. We were there to kind of show the scope of this, you know, really tragic situation, this refugee crisis, which now seems small in comparison to the Syrian refugee crisis, but, like, you know, was extremely a large problem. And here are people who are just like my parents. You know, Iraq was a very professional class country. People were very educated. They, you know, most of the refugees we spoke to were lawyers and pharmacists, and here they are in safety in Syria, but not able to work, and kind of forced to wait for 3 hours every 2 weeks to get a little bit of rice and some oil. And so it's a crowded situation. There's a lot of indignity. And I really, with these panels and this section of the book, wanted to show the crowdedness of what these people were living with. A little note about how I represent language. I struggled trying to decide how to show people speaking in a foreign language. And I was inspired by documentary film and radio documentary, where someone will start speaking in their original language, and then the interpreter will come in kind of overdubbed on top of them. So in all of the scenes where someone is speaking their original language and an interpreter is interpreting, I'll have their balloon kind of sitting on top, and sometimes you can see pieces of Arabic or Kurdish sticking out on the side to kind of show that two people are talking at once. There are scenes like this one, for example, where the interpreter, this young woman that we were with, didn't want to translate what this woman was saying because she was saying some pretty angry words to us as Americans. As you can imagine, Iraqi refugees are pretty angry at what happened and how they were forced to leave their homes. And so I decided to leave that section untranslated because I want you as the reader to kind of identify with a journalist and kind of see what it feels like to be yelled at by an Iraqi woman and to not understand and, you know, to kind of be thinking, like, what am I doing here and what have we done? And so, you know, if you speak Arabic, you can read that section, but if not, you're going to be kind of lost until the next page. I think I have a couple more minutes to talk about process. So I take a lot of photo reference, but I do use my sketchbook and some choice moments. The romantic idea of the comics journalist is that we're, you know, wandering around these places and just drawing everything. But the reality is that drawing takes a long time, and you really can't pay attention to what people are saying when you're drawing. So I mostly took audio and took photos, but there are some situations where you need to draw. For example, interviews where it's more intimate and it would be inappropriate to take pictures. But here is some photo reference. So this is a street corner in Damascus, and this is how I work that into the final panel. My drawing style is really simple, but it's really specific. I want people who have lived in Damascus or lived in Sulaymaniyah, Iraq, to be able to see, like, recognize a place that they know. And I want the minivans in Syria to be Syrian minivans. I want, you know, the guy that makes tea to be accurate. So I take lots of pictures. In Syria, when you first get there, if you went there before now, because you can't go anymore, but pictures of Assad are ubiquitous. They're everywhere, both the current Assad and his father. And it's something that at first is really shocking, but you get used to over time. And so in the book, it's kind of mentioned by the characters as soon as they enter Syria, but as time goes on, I just kind of slipped him into the background there because I want you to kind of have the experience of like getting used to this really jarring image. I can't use photos when I'm at border crossings, so I would often take a lot of sketches there. This is the border crossing into northern Iraq, so you can see that building down at the bottom there becomes that building there at the side. This is the same building on the inside. I'll take sketches kind of like on the left you see there. That's the sketches of these chairs that we were waiting in. But I also use floor plans a lot because floor plans can give you kind of schematic to work from later when you're trying to make an accurate drawing of an interior space. Some places you have to use a combination of drawings and pictures. So we went to a cockfight with one of the people we were interviewing in northern Iraq. Now, this is not technically illegal because the birds don't die. But the men who were there would prefer not to be photographed. So we were told not to take pictures while the event was going on. So I did sketches then. But after everybody left, we were able to take some pictures of the space. And those I worked into the final drawing, kind of combining sketches and photos to make the final work. For my work, I am using cartoons of people. So I often have like one or two photos of the person, and I have to make them into a character. So usually I'll take my sketchbook and I'll do a lot of drawings of them and kind of like try to work out how they'll look from different angles. And then after I'm confident in how they look, I'll start drawing the pencil page there. And then I start watercoloring. All my work is watercolored. I do it all by hand because I don't know how to use Photoshop. And I just like painting. And so this is the end result. This is our fixer of ours named Harb. A very interesting guy and a little bit pissed off at us. And so that is my presentation. I guess I did it within the right amount of time. So good.
Thank you. I think we actually have a fairly significant amount of time left for discussion, so I am going to ask a couple of questions of my own before I open it up to the audience. And so the first thing I want to ask about in thinking about comics as journalism and as visual journalism, most media we think of visual journalism as video or photography, and I see two kind of key differences between the drawn journalism and the photographic journalism. The first, of course, and the most obvious is visual exactitude, the real thing versus the image of the thing. But the second, the one I'm more interested in hearing about is the matter of temporality. A photograph is immediate. You see the thing, you record the image, whereas to record a drawn image, like you said, you spent several years recording 2 months of experiences. And Nakazawa was recording decades after his experiences.
Right, or Joe Sacco calls his journalism slow journalism.
Yeah. So I'm curious what you think that does, what that means for comics as a form of journalism, that there's this essential gap of time between the thing being documented and the documentation of it.
Well, I can maybe just say something quickly and then turn it over to somebody working in this field in a more direct way. But with someone like Joe Sacco, who's the last person profiled in my book in my last chapter, I think it's specifically a kind of ethical stance against the hyperactivity and sped up quality of today's news media. So I think it's actually quite deliberate. I think it's not something he sees as a problem, but something he sees as a value, right? This isn't sort of getting the soundbite or the clip for the nightly news or for the internet news cycle. This is a much more considered slow kind of work that can focus on other kinds of details, everyday life details, what it means to miss your sister's wedding because of a blockade in Palestine, things like that, that wouldn't make it onto the nightly news or the online news cycle.
I agree with that completely. I should mention that there are different kinds of comics journalism. A website like The Nib, which has, it's mostly comics journalism and political comics, does also have faster journalism. They sent Sophie Yano recently to the Dakota pipeline protests, and she was able to report and draw a story about that within several days, which is fairly incredible. And you know, you see a lot of other cartoonists doing work like that. But for a book-length work like this especially, like, I agree that this is something that you want people to be able to read for years to come. And you know, journalism becomes history, right? Like, and this is the way that we learn how to understand our world and the people in it. I think sometimes with journalism, and especially, you know, when I first started thinking about doing journalism, there's this idea that the journalism is going to create an action, that someone will read this and respond in a certain way because of what they just read. Like, they're going to rally for their government to make certain changes. And that can be dangerous sometimes. Like, when you think about the Iraq War, how it was certain journalistic works that kind of like pushed us into the war. And I think that journalism shouldn't always be with the idea that like we learn about something happening now and we try to make a decision about what we as a country or people should do about it. It should be a way for us to understand human beings, to understand the relationships between people and the relationship between people and their governments. And so with a book like mine, you know, this is about a war that at the time was already old and, you know, declared over. And so it's not about the war as it happens, it's about the aftermath. It's about what happens to people who still have to live their lives even though the initial conflict has died down a little bit. So I think that, yeah, we really sometimes we only pay attention to a hot spot in the world when something is actively going on, and then we forget about those people. But for them, those, you know, conflicts are last for the rest of their lives.
Can I pick up on something you said
absolutely.
In the first part of your question?
Sure.
I actually want to push back a little bit on the idea that drawing isn't exact, right?
Sure.
I mean, it's not that photography actually captures reality either. And it's not that prose necessarily captures reality either. So when I teach works like Joe Sacco's Comics Journalism, I tell my students all the time, you think because you read something in the New York Times in prose that it's objective. No, of course it's not objective. You know, there's no such thing as neutral history or neutral journalism. And I think one of the benefits of trying to use drawing to record is that it's often asking people to think about what it means to record in the first place and what it means to document.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful point. We have such an ingrained assumption that photography is intrinsically neutral and objective, and of course it's not. The photographer has to stand somewhere, and that's meaningful.
Right. There's the mechanical objectivity, right? There's the lens, and then, you know, there's framing, right? What's outside the frame? Mm-hmm. That's an issue that comics is always calling attention to, and it's sort of frame-gutter sequence. And then, of course, in the age of Photoshop and digital manipulation,
yeah.
You can never know what's really going on in a photograph today.
Yeah.
Right, and I think that that's a reason why a lot of comics journalists, including Joe Sacco, including myself, include ourselves in the work. You know, it's kind of just to drive the point home a little bit more that we were there, we observed this, and we are human beings that have our own biases, even if we're not going to talk about them that much, to kind of show that, you know, journalism is made by a person. It's observed certain things, and certain things are selected, and that, you know, it's not just like some magical eyeball like floating in and seeing something and then leaving again. And like you said, like I think that the drawn image, especially hand-drawn images, can really just show people that, yes, someone did this. It's not just like a snapshot that you can forget that there was a hand behind that.
Right, but I agree with you totally, and I think that hasn't always been comfortable. And that's part of why I got so interested in comics, was sort of thinking about these questions of taxonomy. So when Art Spiegelman's Mouse came out, it was on the New York Times bestseller list. So for those of you who haven't read Mouse, it's, and you glossed it a little bit too, but it's a work that came out in two volumes in 1986 and 1991 about a cartoonist trying to visualize his father's testimony having survived Auschwitz. So both of Art Spiegelman's parents were Polish Jews. They both survived Auschwitz. They were both in Auschwitz. And Art Spiegelman's mother, Anja, committed suicide when he was 20. And in his early 30s, he got interested in trying to visualize what his father had been through. And this is sort of the basic premise of Maus. So it shuttles back and forth between the 1940s in Poland and the 1970s and 80s in New York. So it comes out, it's on the New York Times bestseller list in the fiction category. And Art Spiegelman wrote to the Times, and he said, David Duke would like to think that what happened to my father was fiction. Yeah. If I had been using the creative license that I think of novelists having, I would have lopped several years off of the 13 I spent researching and writing Maus. And then, you know, one of the features that I haven't yet mentioned, which some of you may know, is that he has an animal metaphor in the book. So he draws Jews as mice. He draws Polish Gentiles as pigs. He draws Nazis as cats, Americans as dogs, British as fish. It breaks down, right? It's a cipher. It's a conceit that the book itself doesn't take too seriously. But then in the end of his letter, he says, I know I've created problems of taxonomy for you. Could you consider adding a new category, nonfiction slash mice? And unbelievably, the Times, for the first time in the paper's history, printed his letter and moved the book from fiction to nonfiction. And this anecdote has been so evocative for me because part of what it indicates is people have a hard time thinking of drawing as a system of communication, as something true, as something non-fictional. And so the editors at the Times were debating about this, and this trickled back to Spiegelman. One of them said, let's go down to Soho and ring Spiegelman's doorbell, and if a giant mouse answers, we'll put it in nonfiction, which of course wasn't going to happen. But people feel really uncomfortable.
Yeah. Okay. I need to open up to the audience now. Do we have any questions from the audience? And let me stress that these must be questions. I will cut you off if you're speaking at length. Yes, sir, please come up.
I feel like we need a better term than comics.
So, oh, thank you for that question. I happen to really like the term comics. So, to me, comics is a medium. That might sound pretty awkward to people's ears. I had to fight for this syntax in academic books and articles, but to me, comics is a medium, the way film is a medium, the way painting is a medium, and so forth and so on. So it's not a genre of art or literature. It's its own art form. It's its own medium. Now, there's a lot of awkwardness around all of this terminology, especially because it's a field that's sort of in flux, and so the terms aren't really codified. But one thing that I've tried to push back on a little bit is that there's this term graphic novel, right? So this is basically a publishing term that became a big deal in the 80s. And cartoonists generally, maybe Sarah feels differently, they like being called cartoonists. And the sort of prestige that graphic novel seems to imply can be irritating to some cartoonists because it's really just a publishing term, and often they're not publishing work that they think of as novelistic at all, right? Especially the creators that I'm interested in who work in nonfiction. So I like comics, I like cartoonists. You know, sometimes they're fictional works that are graphic novels, but I wouldn't call Maus a graphic novel, for example. I call it a graphic narrative, which seems a little bit more inclusive.
I'd love to address that because I actually personally don't care what someone wants to call me or my work. And I do think that we have a problem with terminology. Comics to a lot of people means funny, and I find that when I'm doing my work and I'm telling someone that I'm a comics journalist, they think that means I'm going to make fun of them. I usually bring around an example to show them, like, no, this is serious. But comics has always had a problem. It did start as something funny, you know, and like, so when people say, oh, it's not a graphic novel, I'm like, well, it's not funny either. So, like, I mean, you know, it's kind of hypocritical to say that one is okay and not, one's not. You know, I think of in France, it's called bande dessinée, which means drawn strip, which is a much more accurate word for it. In Spanish, is historietas, which is like small stories. And so I do think that we have a problem with terminology, and I'm really sympathetic to people who don't know what to call it, because it really doesn't make much sense. And it's still really new for a lot of people. And especially with comics journalism, you know, a lot of people know about comics journalism and they like go to Barnes & Noble and they go to the graphic novel section and they read the Nib or whatever, but a lot of people don't. They might not have had exposure to serious comics. And I think that sometimes people can get turned off from the idea without even reading the work because they say, like, I don't want to read funny journalism, that's not serious. So for me, you know, I think that we as comics journalists have a lot of work to do to show people what we can do. And I know that myself and other comics journalists that I know, like, try really hard to make sure that our work is accurate and, you know, has integrity, because we need to work past, like, a little obstacle, which is the terminology that we use for these things.
Yeah. For my part, to add to that is I think it pays to remember that the novel isn't new anymore, but we still call it the novel, and sometimes names just aren't descriptive.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
I'm really curious about, thank you for the conversation on temporality. I thought that was really interesting. But I'm also curious if the nature of the medium sort of determines what kinds of stories get told this way. You know, does it have to be a big piece with a large arc? Is it something where you need to have, I guess, enough of an attention span in the audience to make it worth the effort? And I understand the ethical pushback that you brought up. I was also curious about, you know, because your book came out 5.5 years later, were you tempted to bring in elements of how the conversation about Iraq had changed in your work?
Oh, definitely. And I do have kind of an epilogue that's a year later, so it's when the conflict in Syria has already started. But, you know, the mandate of my project was to report on the reporters at the time that we were there. And, you know, I'm not an expert in what has happened in Syria or Iraq afterwards. So I needed to keep myself limited, even though it's something that I really care about and have done a lot of, like, reading about since then. But when it comes to, you're asking about, I'm sorry, what was the other part of your question?
The kinds of stories you tell.
Oh, yeah. I think it makes a difference, like, what you're reporting on, and there are different kinds of comics that are for each thing. For example, there's lots of comics these days that are more kind of infographic heavy. They're explaining things. They're explaining political conflicts using lots of maps. They're explaining kind of financial systems. And those have a lot more of like the kind of guy narrating like this and like showing you a graph and saying like, and this is what happens, you know. And that, I think, is a great way for people to kind of approach a new topic visually, something that's really complex and might be hard to kind of read a really dense article about, but they can see it broken down into infographics and into kind of images. And for me, the stuff that I work on as these like longer books are more kind of character-based, and they're based around narrative. And so that's a completely different kind of journalism. But there's also, you know, Lisa Hannawalt is a cartoonist who does mostly funny things, but she's done restaurant reviews and movie reviews, and that's comics journalism as well. And that can use humor, and that can, you know, use a completely different kind of storytelling. So I think that comics journalism, we really need to think of it as like a wide open field where people can do lots of different things.
I'll just point out really quickly that a lot of these works that come out as books, like Joe Sacco's book Palestine, for example, which came out in 2000, were serialized as individual comic books. So it was pretty incredible in the early 90s during the First Intifada to have comic books come out that were called Palestine that you could buy for $2.50 at the local comic book store that were so different than the other kinds of comics that you would be able to find at the store. Art Spiegelman's Mouse was also serialized in Raw magazine before it came out as a book from Pantheon. So that question about duration and temporality and the sort of like speed with which you can get something out into the world, I think, in comics has always been addressed in part by the sort of serial nature of comics.
Although we have less floppies and no magazines for comics anymore.
Yeah.
And I guess we have the internet, so that makes up for it.
Yes.
Hi. I'd like to seize on the opportunity of having a comic scholar and a comics artist together to ask Hillary to give a demo and to draw out the complexities of what you call ethical witness by looking at Sarah's frame of the Iraqi woman yelling at her in Arabic.
Can we flip through that?
See what you mean by visual witness and the complexities
of
it.
Is that a question?
That,
Do we feel we can do that in a timely manner?
You can say no.
Well, so I'll just say quickly, just having looked at that image when it came up, because I don't want to bore everyone by doing a big sort of reading with limited time. But one of the things I find so powerful is something that you already pointed out, and I think it's a sort of like perfect illustration of what this form can show. The overlapped balloons, right? So that's something a photograph can't show. That's something that prose can't show. That's a visual conceit. It's a visual gimmick in which you're spatializing and making material on the page people's words, and then the way people's words exist in space temporally. That was really an incredible page.
Oh, I thought that was a really lovely and informative technique. In my reading of it, I stopped at that and really I was lighted by it.
And so since your question was about the idea of ethics and ethical witnessing, I think a panel like that draws a reader into understanding better than the reader might in other media what the interrelationality going on with the people in the frame is. If we think of ethics, broadly speaking, as sort of understanding the other, the attempt to understand the other, I think it's giving us a sort of deeper window into how the dynamics are working there.
Thank you.
Yes.
Hi. Most comics from the superhero style to Art Spiegelman's work and Joe Sacco's deal with trauma and violence. What about comics as a medium do you think lends itself to those topics?
I think that it lends a lot to empathy. At least that's what I like to focus on in my work, and the stuff that is strongest to me allows you to really understand this other person, this hand-drawn person that someone obviously put time into, and I really want readers to be able to kind of empathize with that and understand their trauma in a way, even if they're not, if I'm not showing the trauma as it happened. Something really interesting happens when you're drawing comics. If you're drawing someone smiling, sometimes I'll like realize that I'm smiling like unconsciously, and you know, you're just kind of like, you find yourself like mimicking the person that you're putting on the page. And this happened too with drawing people who are talking about like really traumatic events. The most difficult part of making this book was drawing people talking about losing family members or, you know, witnessing really horrible things, because as you're drawing it, you're kind of embodying them in yourself. And I really hope that that can translate to someone reading it too, but I'm not sure.
I'll just say two formal things. I think one is that the kind of visual detail that one can present in a drawing can be really powerful for displaying certain kinds of scenes of violence. Is something that's quite different than watching a film, for example, because the reader controls the pace. So the reader can put the book down, the reader can linger as long as she wants on an image, but because comics is a print form or a form, you know, that you read on a screen, but that you read at your own pace, I think it can present a certain kind of important visual realism, especially around physical violence, but also give the reader the chance to engage or disengage at her own pace in a way that seems important vis-a-vis thinking about violence and spectacle in general in today's media landscape.
Thank you.
Okay, one last question.
Okay, thanks. I just got one comment and question. There's been some talk about the relationship between photographs and how the drawing can perhaps encapsulate a greater perspective than the original photo. But when you showed that picture of Ben in the space where he shared with his wife, drawn, and then you showed us the photograph, I was completely knocked out by the photograph just because of the that kind of authenticity and psychological space that the photo creates. Why not be open to using photographs as well?
There are cartoonists who have done that. Josh Neufeld recently did a piece on a Syrian refugee journey to Europe, and he used photojournalists photos with the piece. There's a book called The Photographer by Emmanuel Joubert that also uses photos. For me, I feel like it would take out of the narrative. It would like kind of take you out of the experience of going along with these people, and I really want to create an immersive story. You know, this kind of journalism is trying to kind of like take the chaos of a real experience and life and turn it into a narrative, because I feel like that is how like human beings can understand human emotions and life. And so this is a very narrative work, but I can see that there are definitely times when it could be appropriate and beneficial to use photos. But for me, it's just not really part of the work that I'm doing.
I actually find it a little jarring sometimes reading a comic that mixes when you hit that photograph, and it does kind of take you out. And sometimes that can be appropriate, but yeah, I think it can actually detract in a way.
Yeah, I think it's personal choice. And
okay. I believe we've hit the end. So once again, we will be next door signing. If you would like to come talk a little more with Hillary and Sarah, they will be there with their books. And thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be right back.